chapter 4, paragraph 5.
Paragraph 5. Now, here's where we're at. The goal of creation is for man to become as godlike as possible. And he has to do that through his own efforts, otherwise he doesn't resemble God at all because it doesn't belong to him. It doesn't belong to him. It's just given from the outside. Our free will belongs to us, so we are what we have because of ourselves, like he has what he has because of himself. This world is the opportunity to acquire that perfection or those perfections. It's broken up. It's broken up into many different qualities. And each quality depends upon the circumstances, the kind of options the person has, the kind of obstacles he has to overcome, the kinds of resources and inspiration that he has working for him. Each circumstance has its own particular perfection. I'm not 100% clear why it's broken up like this. Why there are thousands upon thousands, as we'll see in part two, maybe endless variations and endless conditions that each one describes a particular circumstance in which there's a particular perfection to achieve. I can answer one question. If we have so many thousands of different aspects, you know, there's charity and self-control and not being lazy and sensitivity and justice, and each one of these is a kind of human perfection, and each one of these can be expressed in a variety of circumstances, each with its own nuances. And each person's life is different. So how do we look at mankind's collective challenge to develop all these perfections versus Adam? Adam had one command. I'm taking these in the simplest possible fashion. I know that Rashim loves the Lashomba, 613, old thing. But the simplest thing is one command. Now, I have said in the past that somehow the whole of what we accomplish has to be rolled up into his one challenge. I said it abstractly because otherwise there's no connection between what he faced and what we're facing. I happen to notice this year, Parshas Bereishis, a statement in Chazal, which says pretty much what I said. That in the tree was rolled up into one all of the commandments, at least all the commandments that apply to the non-Jewish world. All rolled up into one. It wasn't his tree, so he's stealing and he's acknowledging a power other than God, so it's idol worship. And no ways to roll it off all up into one. I don't know if we can really appreciate this, but I want to give you an idea which may, you know, sort of put us in the ballpark. Life is complicated. Think of a person. Now, let's say he is a husband, and he's a father, and let's say he runs a business, which means that he has to study the markets and order the raw materials and set the production quotas and the price and negotiate contracts. And then there are the laws that apply, which he either has to know or get a lawyer to know. And then there are the politicians, because the laws of the state are very important to his business. So he has to negotiate with politicians and decide which politicians to support in their run for office, because which politician gets in, and certainly what kinds of laws will be passed to help his business. He has a lot of different calculations going on. There's his health that he has to worry about. Now let's imagine that his son is a medical doctor who is employed in his business because it's some kind of, let's say, pharmaceutical research, and is running for office for the state legislature. And now he has to make a decision vis-a-vis his son, which of course will impact on his wife, because it's her son also, and other members of the family, and will impact on the business, and will impact on his running for the legislature. Now, can you imagine him calculating this decision? He's done something nasty. Shall I tell him off? What will be with my wife? What will be with the other members of the family? What will be with the business? What will be with running for the legislature? You know, or shall I handle him gently? Think of all the different calculations. And if I tell it off and get into a fight with him, what's going to be with my heart condition? You know, am I risking my health to do that?
Insurance.
Right? Insurance, right? You know what I mean? In this one decision, there could be a dozen different factors, all of which are very important, all of which interact with one another to create a very complex situation. And this one decision, he could make it or break it. And if he breaks it, a lot could break. So I'm just giving you an example of how you can build up connections so that the decision, one decision, can have built into it a whole set of different considerations, all of which will be affected. Now, what we have to imagine, anyway, in analogy with this, but much later, to imagine that all of what we accomplish with the 6, 7, and 13 commandments, in all of the circumstances in which we find ourselves, all of that was wrapped up into Adam's one choice. How to portray that exactly, I don't know. But I'm just telling you that that's what we have to think of, so we understand that what we're doing is connected to what he did. He had all of mankind encapsulated in him, as I've told you that before. We are all slices of Adam. Each human being today is a slice of what he is, was. And our decisions and our chances to achieve relative pieces of human perfection are pieces of what he would have achieved in that one test had he passed. Now, Sartre says, the commandments are the ways in which one achieves human perfection. It's the struggle to perform the relevant commandment at the time that defines the perfection available for that circumstance. Now, we've said that God's purpose was loving kindness, and we have to be like God, so we have to develop loving kindness also. It should follow that all of the commandments are an expression of loving kindness. That's what should follow. And it does follow, although it's not always obvious. Sometimes it is obvious, and sometimes you have to look very deeply to see where loving kindness is a particular commandment. So, for example, if you lend money to someone, the Talmud says, you lend money and he owes it to you. Let's say the time for paying has come and he hasn't paid you. So it's collectible. And you're walking down the street, and you see him walking down the street opposite you. You should cross over to the other side of the street, so you shouldn't embarrass him by meeting him in the street. Now, just a minute here. I lent him money, and you know that according to Jewish law, I can't collect any interest. I'm doing him a gigantic favor. You know, if I hadn't lent him the money, I could have put it in the stock market and lost it. I mean, I could have, you know, made a profit, supposedly, after a while. And now I have to get out of his way that he shouldn't see me when I'm walking down the street? Yes, that's right. It's not enough to lend the money. There has to be interpersonal sensitivity that goes with it. The moral, spiritual quality of chesed is quite obvious in that case. Similarly, in charity, there are two verses. One is don't harden your heart, and the other is don't tighten your fist. I suppose don't tighten your fist means give. Alright? So giving. So why then does the Torah say also don't harden your heart if I'm already giving? One of the commentators says it's not enough to give. You have to share his pain. You have to feel, you have to empathize with him. Of course, if you empathize with him, he'll see that, he'll know that. The comfort he gets is not just that you gave him money, but also that he feels you sharing his pain. So here, the quality of chesed, of loving kindness, is really quite obvious. In those cases, it's on the surface. In other cases, it's not on the surface, but if you dig deeply enough, you'll see. I'll give you one example just to show you the kind of things that's in store as you dig deeper into the various mitzvot. You're studying Torah. You're sitting in the Beis Medrash, 50 feet from here, along with 180 other Jews who are all studying those Iraqi volumes, you know, from our ancestors 1500 years ago in Babylon, which is Iraq. So what does that have to do with loving kindness? I'm just studying that stuff. Oh, okay, it's holy and it tells me what to do, how to serve God. It's very interesting and challenging. Where's the loving kindness in it? Now the Gemara in the Dorim quotes a verse. Were it not for my covenant, day and night, the laws of heavens and earth would not be stable, so to speak. I wouldn't have put them, made them. Yeah. And one explanation of the Gemara is that my covenant, day and night, is the study of Torah. It means that when a Jew is studying Torah, he's maintaining the existence of the universe. That's not exactly obvious, that the existence of the universe depends upon people studying Torah. But you know, if you have your eyes open and read about modern science, there's a lot in modern science that isn't obvious. Chlorofluorocarbons damage the ozone layer. Do you know where the big central hole in the ozone layer is? Over Antarctica. Now, how do those clever CFCs know? How do those, you know, you're using a spray can in New York, and those clever CFCs know to go 8,000 miles south to the South Pole? I mean, how do they know that?
Jet stream.
What's that?
Jet stream.
Did jet stream go south over the equator? Last time I looked, I'm sorry. My jet stream starts in the Caribbean and goes up the east coast of the United States and turns right, and that's why the flight from here to America, it takes 2 hours longer than the flight from America to here. Because when you're coming here, you get the jet stream behind you, and you're going against the jet stream. That's why sometimes they run out of fuel going from here to America, and have to land in Canada, which is the worst of all possible worlds. Especially if a connecting flight, you know, that you're waiting for in New York. It happened to be twice. Okay, back to work. So,
it all comes down to
the study of Torah. Now, that means, I said this on my own for many years, and I heard that Rabbi Tzio Solomon and Lakewood said it, so now I know this, right? That one thing that you should have in mind when he sits down to study Torah is I am contributing to the existence of the universe, and it's a chesed. It's an act of loving kindness when I study. I'm not just studying to elevate my soul, I'm not just studying to know how to serve God. I'm also studying as part of the collective effort of enabling coal miners in Shanghai to dig coal out of the mountains and enabling people at Cambridge University discover the secrets of black holes, and all of that depends on the efforts that Jews exert in studying Torah. So the principle here is that if you go deeply enough into any mitzvah, you'll find that its ultimate payoff is a kind of loving kindness, and therefore in every mitzvah you are really living out what God said is the purpose of the creation. Yeah.
Just as a comment, it depends how you look at it. You said with the
for charity. If you give a person charity, you have to cross the street. And you say, why should I have to cross the street? Well, that's if you look at it as if you're doing him a favor. But if you look at it that he's doing you a favor in order for you to get reward, so really you're actually he's doing you a favor and you cross the street as, you know,
100% correct. I was just expressing the wrong attitude, but you're 100% correct. That's exactly right. Yeah.
How would you see that in something like Shabbos or something like I keep Shabbos?
Well, I think you should already be able to appreciate that there could be a whole method here based on what I said about the study of Torah, right?
Is that right? That's going to just apply to every method that, oh, I'm keeping Shabbos, so I'm keeping the world going because the world needs to have mitzvot?
Well, not that it's going to be exactly the same, but there's going to be a metaphysical connection. For example, a number of times in the Torah and in the prayers and other places, we speak about Pnei Ha'adamah, the face of the land. You know, okay, so what could that mean? The surface? But then Kayin, with Kayin is, when God says, I'm banishing you, he says, Me'al Pnei Ha'adamah, from on the face of the land. Now, where did Kayin go? Into orbit? I mean, turns out that Pnei Ha'adamah, in many contexts, means the land of Israel. So then, as the commentators put it, you know, when you face a person, when you interact with a person, we're talking about a face-to-face conversation, because the face communicates and receives the basic information about the person. Right? I think there's body language, but that's secondary to facial expression. Speech. The face of the land of Israel, is where the land as a whole turns to interact with the other half, the upper half. So then, all of the blessings of the world come to the world through Eretz Yisrael, through the land of Israel. When we pray for a good year, we speak about its coming to the land of Israel. Now, if a Jew is in New York, he also wants help in New York, but he understands it has to come through. So now, if we're living in Israel, and we are, let's say, keeping the agricultural laws, which then reinforces the sanctity of the land, that's going to have an effect on the land as a carrier of the blessings for the world as a whole. So it's going to be metaphysical, but it isn't going to be just a copy, you know, a carbon copy of studying Torah maintains, so this maintains, so that maintains, it's not going to be a carbon copy. But it's good. You see what I'm saying?
I see, but like, let's say I'm sitting in New York and I didn't light a cigarette on Shabbos. That's not the same. That's not the land. That's not being land.
Okay, so each one will have its own its own application that way. The world was created. Why Shabbos the seventh day of the week? I mean, we'll get to this. We get to part four. Why is Shabbos the seventh day of the week? Not as the Christian calendars have it, the first day of the week. You know what I'm talking about. Which day is the first day of the week according to the Christian calendar?
Sunday.
Sunday. Which is their celebration of Sabbath?
Sunday.
There's something peculiar there, boys and girls.
They don't want it to be the same day as ours.
Well, ultimately that's true.
Simple as that.
Ultimately that's true historically. Historically what happened was, early Christianity had 2 days a week which were celebrations. I don't know if they took off from work the whole time, but anyway, the celebrations. One was Saturday, which was the biblical Sabbath, and one was Sunday, which was the day of the resurrection. When Constantine made the Roman Empire Christian, he said to the Christian leaders, you're not getting 2 days a week. Pick one. Simple as that. No. Or maybe I'll go Greek, you know. Constantine never became Christian. He remained a pagan until the end of his days. He didn't care about it. He just wanted to unify the empire. So they had to choose. So they moved the biblical Sabbath to Sunday. I don't know exactly what authority they had to do that. Pushed it over. But it ruins it, because the fact that Shabbos is the end of the week is crucial. Crucial to the nature of Shabbos. What does the word Shabbat mean in Hebrew? No.
Sit.
Within. What? Sit? Let go. You guys are awful. Some of you heard it from me before. Gross? It
means kind of ceasing.
To cease doing something. In modern Hebrew, how do you say a strike in modern Hebrew? Shemitah. Of course, that does rest on an assumption. The assumption is that they've been working up until now, not stopping, right? Yeah, you know, who knows in Israel? But all right, you can't stop at the beginning. You can't start by stopping. Stopping comes at the end. You can't have the stopping day as the first day of the week. It's nonsensical. The word, the concept of stopping is the name of the day, Shabbat. So, the reason it's at the end, the reason it's stopping day is because it's the purpose. The goal of the 6 days activity is to reach the seventh day. And what happens on the seventh day is the purpose for which the 6 days were dedicated. So, what you do on Shabbos relates directly to the purpose of creation, whereas what you do in the 6 days is only a means to that end. So, the ability of the end of creation, the purpose of creation, to be felt and affected and active now depends upon our keeping of Shabbos. I'll give you a parallel. This is actually a chazal. The Medrash says that if the non-Jews had known what they got out of our temple, they would have created legions of soldiers and ringed it around to protect it from all harm. It means that our temple brought into the world a connection with spirituality which affects everybody. It affects everybody. But some appreciate where it comes from. Some appreciate where it comes from. So by bringing the sacrifices in the temple, we have a key to a spiritual funnel which spreads out and has effect on the whole world. All of this affects the world as a whole, each thing in its own way. Shabbos, in a way, helps us. You're tempting me. Shabbos, in a way, helps us achieve some of the things that gives me the purpose of creation that would otherwise be lost. I will do this because it's just to give out the brown books. I want to show you something.
Push me to go so far, so.
This is something, yeah, that's what's it. This is something which occurred to me just a couple of months ago, and I think it's quite important that you get to my age. Things are still occurring to you, so you feel very alive. Look at the Chadoyi, which is on page 250. What's that? 316. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. The refrain is always, come, my beloved, to greet Shabbos. Let us accept to greet the bride. Let us accept the Shabbos present. Now let's look at the intermediary verses. Safeguard and remember the single utterance. The one and only God made us here. Those are the two commandments of Shabbos in the twice that it's said in the Torah. Shem is one. His name is one. This verse talks about Shabbos. There are two commands. One to remember, the other to safeguard. And then the refrain is, come, my beloved, to greet the bride, the Sabbath presence. Next one, to welcome the Sabbath, come, let us go, source of blessing, beginning, antiquity, she was honored, last indeed, first in thought. All that is about Shabbos. Come, my beloved, to greet the bride, the Sabbath presence, let us welcome. Now, O sanctuary of the king, royal city, that is, not Mecca. Jerusalem. Okay. Arise and depart from it of evil. You're sitting ruined. Too long have you dwelt in the valley of weeping. He will shower his compassion upon you. Okay. The city is sitting there in ruins and weeping. And this verse imagines the ultimate redemption coming. That it should arise and depart from the being overturned. God will shower his compassion upon you, the city of Jerusalem. Come, my beloved, to greet the bride, the Sabbath present, let us welcome. What? How do we get back to Shabbos? And what's this doing here? Shake off the dust, arise, don your splendid clothes, my people, to the side of Yishai, the Bethlehemites. In other words, bring David Ben, David HaMelech, bring the Mashiach. Draw near to my soul, redeem it.
redeem the city of, redeem the people of Israel, bring the ultimate redemption, let's go with your Shabbos. What's the connection here? What is the refrain doing in all these cases? Wake up, for your light has come, rise and shine, wake up, so the glory of Hashem is revealed to you, that's the ultimate redemption, come, let's greet Shabbos. Feel not ashamed, you know, who are you, downcast, disconsolate, in you my people, this is Yerushalayim again, right? People's afflicted find shelter, cities built on the hilltop, I'm picturing Yerushalayim rebuilt, finally redeemed, let's go greet Shabbos. What is the connection here? So I think the answer is that we are experiencing the desolation of knowing that we are in exile, that the temple is not built, that the Temple Mount is covered by those abominable Muslim buildings. And in that sense of loss, that sense of pain, that sense of frustration, Shabbos can compensate. Shabbos can compensate for those things. Shabbos carries in it something that's relevant to that loss and can function as a kind of temporary crutch, not full replacement, not satisfactory replacement, but a temporary crutch to carry us through this particular loss and this particular problem. Now, my Rebbe's brother, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, explained this to me many years ago in the context of a slightly different question, but his explanation went like this. That there are three dimensions of the creation. Space, time, and soul. Each dimension has a focus of Kedusha, of sanctity. In space, the focus is the temple. In time, the focus is Shabbos. And in soul, the focus is the Jewish people. And the three are meant to interact with one another and create a coordinated, integrated whole. So, comes Friday afternoon, a Jew, feeling the holiness of his own soul, feeling Shabbos approaching, knowing that he's shortly going to have two out of three, then the third presses itself on his consciousness that if we only had the third, it would be complete. When you have one out of three, the fact that you're missing the other two, so you only have a fragment. But when you have two out of three and you're only missing one, then the tragedy of the loss of the other one becomes very, very poignant, you experience it more deeply. So when you're coming to greet Shabbos, you can't help but have your mind move to the missing one and to acknowledge the pain of lacking the third and to anticipate ultimately recovering the third so that the picture will be complete.
What are we lacking in Jewish people?
No, the temple.
You said time, time, space, and soul relates in how?
Each one has a focus. A focus of sanctity. In time, the focus is?
Shabbos.
And in soul, the focus is? And in space?
What was it? Was it
the temple? And that we don't have. So that's what we're missing. So now, on the one hand, I'm missing the third, and I feel the loss of it, and I'm anticipating the recovery of it. On the other hand, we do have two out of three. And I appreciate with the two out of three, we can do something that's relevant to what we wish we could do if we had all three. We can do something. So the Shabbos enables me to focus on that sanctity and realize it so that it will have its effect on the world. But not wholly, not completely. I think that's why the relevance of the refrain to all these verses that are really not talking about Shabbos at all. The answer is that Shabbos can compensate for those lost things. Compensate partially, of course, not wholly. Anyway, that's enough of a digression.
Yeah.
The concept that you mentioned about Torah learning, as long as somebody's learning Torah at a time, maintaining patience, is that idea go back right to the beginning of creation?
Okay. You hear his question? What's the answer?
When the Torah is given?
Yes. Everything that we're doing, but if we're saying that everything that we're meant to do is included in what Adam's choice, then I'm guessing that's somehow in there.
What was the question?
His question was, this idea that the study of Torah that maintains the existence of the universe, does that go all the way back to the beginning of creation?
Yeah, Torah was created before the universe. Before.
You're not answering your question, are they?
Oh.
No. No. Now, pull out the plug. What's the proof that it's not so?
The proof that...
The answer to your question is no.
Because the Torah was only given...
And in between... Let's say Adam did it, okay? I don't mind. But first of all, he failed. He didn't do it. But let's say, but think of all the time between Adam and the giving of the Torah. What happened in all that time? In rabbinic language, that's called the 2,000 years of Tohu. Tohu means formlessness. Like before the creation of light, that's the word that's in the first chapter of Genesis. Right? Formlessness, it's wasteland. But people were living. People were tilling the soil, people were building cities, people were fighting wars. I mean, it isn't as if nothing was going on. So I have no idea. Isn't that interesting? So the answer is that there is a period of time of preparation. One of the places, I think it's Lutzato who says in one of his stories that it's like a child. First, the child is a fetus in the womb, totally dependent upon his mother. Then afterwards, he's nursing, also dependent upon his mother and for nutrition, on his parents for protection and training and so on. He goes through stages. Now, why do the parents invest in all of this? They invest in it because someday he's going to be independent. So all of this for the sake of the independence. So if you're really clever, you could say that the later period of independence is what is justifying and bringing about the earlier period of being sustained. Because it's for the sake of that. But when you get there, stand on your own 2 feet. Right. So that's what Chazal mean when they say that from the creation, the world was waiting for the sixth of Sivan when God would give the Torah to the Jewish people. Because if they don't receive the Torah, the whole world goes to pieces. It goes back to formlessness and void. What's happening all the time up until then? Well, you're talking about a fetus or an immature child. He can't stand on his own. The world has to be carried to a certain point, and then from then on, it's got to carry itself. So that's the idea. It was a very good question. Okay, that's now... We're still in chapter 5. Now, one crucial element here in paragraph 5 is that these mitzvos, the commandments, are laid down by God based upon the objective nature of the soul, its capacities, its relationship to the environment, to the body, and to the ultimate future. The key word is objective. Which means that the fact that I am thrilled by what I'm doing, or bored to tears by what I'm doing, or irritated by what I'm doing, or I'm in pain because of what I'm doing, says absolutely nothing about whether it's right or wrong. The idea of creating a Judaism that would be more palatable and more easy to market and would make people feel happier is simply, it would be like doing that in medicine. My medical practice is designed to make you feel happy and satisfied and inspired. You know, that's what we do here. I don't think you belong there. I don't think you'll be going to pay this guy to make you feel happy, satisfied, and inspired. You want to be healthy. And if health costs some pain, I'd rather have the pain and have the health than feel happy and inspired by what he tells me to do. That's the key to it being objective. You know, in my Reform synagogue, there was an option. You could come to this synagogue on Saturday or on Sunday because, you know, you might have golf on Saturday. So you have to have an option. But isn't life about options? And why shouldn't Judaism give you options? Well, it depends. If Judaism is essentially self-serving play, then indeed you should have all the options in the world. What's wrong with Tuesday? You know, I mean, why should you be Saturday? You want a long weekend, you know? You want to go to the mountains. Why do you want to go to synagogue? Make synagogue on Tuesday. But if you're dealing with the objective perfection of the person, soul and body, in this environment, vis-a-vis God, so then the whole perspective is entirely different. That's some observation captured on paragraph 5. Now, paragraph 6 says something about the mitzvot, which is also not obvious, but it's very, very important. The root of all the service of God is that a person should turn to his Creator continuously. Turn to Him. And that is, he should know and understand, interestingly, not know and believe, but know and understand, that he was created only to cleave to his Creator. Take us. And he was put in this world only to conquer his evil inclination and to subjugate, but the idea is to wholly dedicate himself to his Creator through the strength of his mind, the opposite of the desires of the physical and the physical's inclination, and he should guide his actions or manage his actions for this purpose, to achieve this purpose, and not to turn aside from it. It means that there is a mental component in the service of God. This is something which I think is a point people miss, or they misconstrue. There's a deep philosophical idea here. What is an action? What does it mean to do something? To act. An action is not just moving your body. An action is not just moving your body. Two people can move their bodies in the same way and be performing different actions. A human action is a will, a purpose, a value, a worldview expressed in a bodily motion.
What's the difference?
Sorry?
What if it's
Then I don't call it an action. An action is something you choose to do, not something just your body moves by itself. Imagine somebody asks for charity. Now, there are two different purposes a person may have in giving the charity. One is to help someone in need, and the other is to get him off your back. He's a pain in the neck. My wife pointed out to me last night something which I was shocked at. Reading in a sefer about anonymous charity. Right? A person gives charity anonymously, you may injure him by revealing that he gave it. He wants to keep it secret. Why would it injure him? So she said, some people give charity anonymously so that other people won't know that they're giving the charity, because if people know they're giving the charity, there's going to be a line in front of their door waiting for more charity. So they don't want people to know. That never occurred to me. I thought a person gave charity anonymously out of humility. He didn't want the credit, didn't want the honor. No, he doesn't want more application. That's what he doesn't want. I'm so naive. My wife thought that was very cute. Now, of course, there's certainly some of both kinds. But now, think of this. The guy's giving charity, and he says, please don't use my name. What kind of action is that? The two people will say, don't use my name, and the action in the case is going to be two entirely different actions. There's a mental component in human action. You can't understand a human action unless you put humanity into the description. And the humanity is, what does the person think he's doing? What is he trying to do? What are his goals? What is his picture of the world that he's living in? That's why novels are so powerful. Because they put you inside the mind of the person. No novel will tell you, his right hand moved and his leg moved and then, the meters moved. And they want you to feel what's going on inside. That's the purpose of it, to become acquainted with the human reality. Now, we have this reflected in halakha. To do a mitzvah, to fulfill a mitzvah, you must intend as you do it that it should fulfill your obligation. Now listen, you know me. You guys know me already. I'm using these words, and I mean these words and only these words. Don't use other words. It won't be what I meant. You must intend. Here's the example the Mishnah gives. I'm a sofer. I'm writing a sefer Torah. Now, there's a mitzvah, actually, to say, you have to do it, but it's best if you say the words as you write. So I'm writing. I happen to be in Parshas Vashana, in Dvorim. I write. Shema. Yisrael. Hashem. Okay, Hashem Echad. I'm writing Sefer Torah. It's my job. I get paid for this, And I look at my watch and I say, gosh, it's 7:45 in the morning. This is the time of the mitzvah of reciting Shema. And I just said it. I just did it. I said all the words. So I have fulfilled the mitzvah. The answer is no. You have not fulfilled the mitzvah.
because you did not intend, as you said, that you're saying the word should satisfy that obligation. You're just writing the same Torah. You have to have an intention that it should fulfill the mitzvah. Either you have to have the intention live, yes, I want this to work, I want this to count. Or it has to be a general policy. You know, I only do it when I put on tefillin. I don't put them on because I keep my arms warm, and then I don't put them on to flex my muscles. I put them on because of the mitzvah. So, you know, it could be. I mean, we're Hasidim, so we say the whole paragraph before we put them on. Clearly what we want to do. But even another person who generally puts them on only to fulfill the mitzvah, it'll be good enough. But if you have some other intention as you're doing it, then it doesn't do the job.
Even if you have the intention of putting on tefillin, plus you have another intention?
No, this is important. Yes, you can have lots of intentions. All you need is to have the intention that it fulfills the mitzvah. Other intentions together are perfectly all right. That's perfectly all right. Notice, I didn't say that you're doing it for the reason of fulfilling the mitzvah. I didn't say that. I didn't say that the mitzvah is motivating you. I didn't say that either. Could be that you're motivated by embarrassment. Everybody's putting on tefillin. What? I'm going to be the only one who doesn't. Could be that your father's paying you. You know, you're 13 years old and recalcitrant, like a natural American kid. So your father's paying you to put on tefillin. That doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. We're not talking about motivation now. We're not talking about the reason why you do it. We're talking about having the intention. Okay, my father's watching. I got to do it. But I want it to count. That's enough. I want it to count. As against someone who doesn't think of the mitzvah at all. Doing it because he's trying it on, which you sometimes have. You know, the person selling the film will say, try them on to see if they fit, and I'll adjust the knot. Then you can't say that you did the mitzvah because you're just trying it on. You have the mitzvah in mind. So this mental component is crucial. Without this mental component, you didn't do the mitzvah. Now, Lutzata's going a step further. Lutzata's saying there are the legal rules, the rules that are necessary, without which you don't fulfill the mitzvah. And then there's the purpose of the whole exercise, which, the more you accomplish it, the more higher quality the mitzvah is. The purpose of the mitzvah is to turn to God, think about God, relate to God, experience God, to be in dialogue with God, to be in contact with God. Or, if you like, you can use what was the jargon in my time, and that's God consciousness. It's promote God consciousness. To be conscious of God. That's really the guts of the mitzvah. The trappings is the motions of the body. God has to be there, at least in the sense that I intended to fulfill the commandment. To intend to fulfill the commandment of God means I have something about God in mind. But the more I can feel my connection, the more of me that is turned towards God in the performance, so I have a quality performance. That's why you study the reasons for the commandments, the biblical allusions, and the Talmudic connections, and the Midrash, and if you get that far, to the Kabbalistic ideas, because the richer a conception you have, the richer the experiences. The richer the experiences, the more of you is involved in turning towards God. And that's the purpose of the whole thing. The purpose of the whole thing, the Zohar says that there are 613 strategies. Very interesting. The classical term is mitzvos. Mitzvah means command. So the picture you get is, there's an authority to tell me what to do. And I knuckle under and do it. The Zohar says there are 613 strategies. Strategies for accomplishing a goal. This is the goal. The goal is turning to God, feeling a connection with God, directing your attention to God, knowing and understanding that you are created to turn toward and detach yourself to your Creator. That's the picture in paragraph 6. Yeah.
The whole debate idea, is that more spiritual than physical, or how is it laying out?
So we spoke about this last time. He says, right, his descent is his ascent, that the interaction with the physical is the means whereby you achieve this connection. I'll give you one illustration, which is from a couple of weeks from now, but I'll give you one illustration. And you should ask other people about this. I mean, this is a desperate thing. It's really beautiful. Abraham is having a vision of God. He sees the three wayfarers. So, according to one expert, says to God, would you mind waiting, Pip? You know, I have something to do. And he runs off and he greets the wayfarers and serves them.
From here the Talmud says, greater is hospitality to travelers than receiving the divine presence. So they all ask, okay, we who know what Abraham did, we can deduce this. But how did he know what to do? There's a whole literature on that. Avdessa says, I'm putting it in my terminology, but it's his idea. If you think of this as apples and oranges, receiving God's presence on the one hand and serving travelers on the other hand, it would be very difficult to know which are more valuable, the apples or the oranges. What you have to appreciate is that it's two things in the same ballpark, in the same dimension. And the dimension is dveikus, attaching yourself to God. Now, how do you attach yourself to God? Ultimately, by becoming God-like. That's the means of attaching yourself to God. Now ask yourself, you're receiving God's presence. Hear the key word, receiving. God is present to you, giving you a vision of His presence. So your role is the role of a recipient. God is giving and you're receiving. Right? Are you similar to Him? You're opposite to Him. He's giving, you're receiving. What do you have in common? Except you're holding, each one's holding one end of the stick. But in terms of the activity, He's giving and you're receiving. That's a very low level connection. When you go out to serve wayfarers, you are then directly godlike. You're caring for them as He's caring for you. Says Rav Desta, the quality of dveikus, of attachment to God, is higher when you're serving travelers than it is when you're receiving His presence in a vision. The quality of attachment is higher. That's what he says. It's apples and apples. Which is the higher quality of attachment? And the one in which you're more similar is the one where the attachment is going to be higher. That's it.